Hey, everybody, I'm Chris Fafalius, and I'm the producer of Krista Makes a Podcast and the host of the One Hit Thunder podcast.
And I'm Matt Kelly, host of Horror Movie Night and the producer slash the head of content for the Geekscape Podcasting Network.
Between the two of us, we have, believe it or not, 25 years of podcasting experience, and we want to help you start your own podcast.
We know podcasting, and we want to share that knowledge with you.
So whether you're new to podcasting or you want some feedback on your currently active podcast, we want to help.
Or perhaps you're just overwhelmed with all of the editing work. Well, we can help you with that also.
You can check out our website at weknowpodcasting.com for more information.
We're excited to help your podcasting dreams become a reality. Would have ever thought we would make it to 300 episodes of this stupid fucking show.
Hey, don't like, you talk bad about my show.
Here we are, guys, 300 episodes. I can't believe we did it. I can't believe we somehow pulled this off.
Feels like 100.
Yeah.
Maybe because we've only been 100.
Yeah. Good joke.
I'll be here all week.
We've been talking about doing Pee-wee's Big Adventure for like since before Brian was on the show. We've brought up Pee-wee's Big Adventure pretty regularly. But then the addition of Brian and how frequently him and I will just quote random lines of this movie to each other in our day-to-day life, it just felt like a very appropriate episode 300. So here we are talking about Pee-wee's Big Adventure, the first Tim Burton movie. Some could argue the best Tim Burton movie in a lot of ways. In all joking aside, I think that this is, when you think about it from a standpoint of a first-time director, he really nailed what the Tim Burton aesthetic would be from here on out, right out the gate.
Like, the funniest thing about watching this for me was, rewatching this for me was, it still feels nightmarish. I think I've mentioned this to you guys before, but maybe the context here is important. But growing up, when I'd get a lot of ear infections. And when I would get ear infections, I would get these ridiculous headaches and fevers. And when you're all feverish and trying to sleep, things don't make sense. And the reoccurring thing was kind of like this waking nightmare where I'd try to hold objects. I was like basically asleep, but I'd try to hold objects in my hand, right? But the objects would continue to expand and contract. And it was horrifying to me because, for whatever reason, I couldn't control it. It was like a very unsettling feeling. Watching Pee-wee's Big Adventure is the same thing, because like his fork and knife are massive, and his bowl of cereal, and like everything about this, like the sizes of everything are out of whack, and it still makes me feel uncomfortable.
The set design is like,
where did he get the money for all that?
So there is a fan theory that Pee-wee is rich for inventing a series of Rube Goldberg machines.
Oh, okay. That would make a lot more sense.
And then that money just like rolled into him being able to just like live his man-child dreams. One of the jokes that I don't think I ever really appreciate it, but I love that this movie is called Pee-wee's Big Adventure and the credits are so small and minimalist when it pops up. Like, it's such a dumb joke, but the opening credits are so boring and plain right out the gate. And I was like, that's really, really funny. But like, also, this is Danny Elfman's first attempt ever doing a film score. And again, I think he nailed it out of the park. Like, even that beginning, bicycle race, the Pee-wee theme, oh, yeah, the breakfast song, like, the whole first 10 minutes of this, there's so many good musical motifs that pop out throughout the rest of the movie that have that childlike wonder. But then, yeah, Pee-wee wakes up from his dream of riding in the Tour de France, and it is just set design chaos out the ass the second you see this bedroom. Like,
yeah, I do love his workout regimen because it reminds me of my workout regimen.
Yeah, two solid efforts with some dumbbells and calling
those are
it
like
day.
3 pound dumbbells.
Yeah,
like, that's me.
It's so funny because I didn't really write any lines or like anything down.
Really?
For the first 20 minutes of this movie, I was just like sucked back into any time I watch it where I'm just sitting there quoting it. Where I'm just like, I know you are, but what am I? Like, just so he's so fucking funny right out the gate. The actor who plays Francis plays that role so well as just like the most obnoxious, spoiled rich kid.
Well, that's what's so great about the two of them is that Pee-wee is rich man-child with a heart of gold, and Francis is rich man-child that is awful. And so yeah. It's like they're the mirror images of each other. But the funniest thing, and also like Pee-wee's skinny and Francis is fat. I love Francis's jumpers.
Yes, it is the least complimentary outfit that he could possibly be wearing. But oh my god, just my dad says I can have anything I want. Everything about Francis makes me so happy. When he shows up at Francis's house after the bike has gone missing, and like what was the one line? He's like, Francis is taking his bath. Oh really? Where are they hosing him off? Like that whole attack in the pool. Like it's all chaos. But there's so many weird little in jokes with the movie as well. Like. I love one of the first scenes that scared me as a kid. We're going to talk about a lot of things that like kind of freaked us out.
This is all kind of trauma. This dude, movie is total horror material.
Okay, so that's the two of you, because I never understood that. Like, the first time I thought less of my siblings, I can remember both of them. It was Matt being afraid of the clown scene in Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Oh, God, yeah.
And Jamie being horrified at Weird Al getting fat in the Fat music video. It was like the two times I was just like, you guys are older than me.
But yeah, like they go into the magic shop, and the magic shop sequence is so weird and so bizarre. But it's when he's showing him the different shrunken heads. And then the last head he brings up is a giant Aleister Crowley head, which is so funny. Like,
I know I didn't get that as a child because I didn't know who Aleister Crowley was, obviously. But it's everything is scary in this movie. Yeah. Like, and the goddamn, or maybe it's not scary, but it's
unsettling.
Dread. It induces dread, you know, in me. Even the goddamn clown waving statue, that was horrifying to me. Here's a story I have never told on the podcast. There was this spitting head clock. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It was a clock with a head that would spit water when you were near it. It would spit water at you. It was like a gag gift. It looked like a folk German outfit. Like you had one of those green hats on. You know what I'm talking about? Like,
I'm picturing this clock. All right.
And it's got like a little
feather
like
type
a little
deal?
Feather in it and. And he had like these big cheeks and a big nose, and he would laugh and spit water at you. And it was at the top of the stairs, or like if you would go down the stairs at this family friend's house to the basement, it was like right at the bottom of the basement stairs looking at you. So you literally could not get down to the basement to play with your friends without going past the spitting head clock. And that feeling of dread that the clown statue and the spitting head clock gave me right around the same time as a child are inexorably linked.
Yeah, they really went out of their way to try to make this unsettling. And I think they do a really good job. Like, the dream sequences are very unsettling. And, like, as a kid, I didn't get it. Now, as an adult, I'm like, oh, they pulled so much German expressionism stuff to, like, create that weird dreamlike atmosphere in these scenes. Like, the clown hospital scene is amazing. Like, the way it is shot is just incredible. And it is like, what I love in that specific dream is that it really is summing up the whole movie in like a 2-minute sequence up until that point, where it's like the clown statue, the shattered bike, they're putting it on a hospital gurney because he like left the bike shop on a gurney, and then like they're putting it together, and then the main clown is Francis with the creepy clown makeup. Like, it's just so much different.
Was the
like,
main clown Francis? I thought Francis was the devil.
I think he's both.
That clown was pretty skinny.
Oh, maybe that's true. I don't know, but yeah. When he pulls down the surgical mask and it's that creepy clown face and he just starts laughing at Pee-wee, like, there's something unsettling about it. It's not like, oh, I'm going to run and hide in my room like I did when
no,
I saw...
No, it just makes you feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, like when I saw Christopher Lloyd... eyeballs fall out.
Ah!
Like, that was me running and hiding in another room until the movie was over. Pee-wee, I kept watching, but I was like, there's something that doesn't feel okay about
yeah.
this.
Man, you're so lucky. I didn't know that your first time watching Who Framed Roger Rabbit was at home, because I was in a theater.
Oh, no, I was at my grandmother's house in front of all of my cousins, so they made fun of me about it for, like, years.
Oh, yeah, you have told this story, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, my cousin Dave would just follow me around going, I sounded like this, Eddie, with his... It's like, you're a bad friend.
So, joke's on you, I'm not your friend.
But yeah,
he's gonna
I mean,
invite you over to a sleepover, and then you guys are gonna read comic books on separate sides of the basement.
But yeah, so like, you have all of like the build up to the road trip is fantastic. What I really appreciate about this movie, and it's again, it's like those levels of brilliance. If he wasn't so recently on the Patreon, I almost wanted to have Jonathan on, because Pee-wee's Big Adventure is almost a remake of Jonathan's favorite movie of all time, which is The Bicycle Thief, which is like a 1947, I believe it's a French film. And it's literally about a guy whose prized bicycle gets stolen, and he calls the cops and no one believes him. So he goes on a road trip to find the people that stole his bike. And they literally just like follow. Like, I remember when I watched The Bicycle Thief for the first time. It's not a funny movie, but I kept laughing because I was like, they literally took this script and just were like, but what if Pee-wee was doing it? like, hits the beats. So it's kind of like I've said before, like when I watched Chinatown or The Graduate for the first time, there was part of me that kept laughing because I was suddenly understanding all of the parodies of those films that I had seen prior, that I'm like, dude, those parodies nailed these. Like, they knocked these out of the fucking park. But like, it didn't, like, it actually kind of ruined my experience watching the actual classics. I want to jump, unless you guys have anything that you want to talk about before Pee-wee goes on his road trip.
I do just want to point out something as a whole.
Yeah.
Because I hate to say it, Matt, but I don't think you're qualified to make this statement, because rose tinted goggles are tattooed on your face. But someone who can take them off. I went in fully expecting this to be like a nostalgic watch. I forgot that this is legitimately like a very funny movie. Like, somebody with no prior knowledge, or like, if I showed this to Jade and she never saw it, I think she would laugh. Like, this is actually a really funny fucking movie as a comedy.
It's definitely the best that they've ever done for a Pee-wee movie.
Oh, well, this was pre-kids, right? This is when he was doing the adult show. And then everything else, like Big Top Pee-wee, was like, he was a kid show at that point.
Yeah, no, that's also true.
Thank you for asking and answering that question, because I was going to ask what the chronology was. Do you think that this movie is funny, including the shit that became like memes, like the Pee-wee dance and the I Know You Are But What Am I thing, and like some of the other things that are just so Pee-wee? They're like ubiquitous now. Like, I found those to be very cringy. I enjoyed everything but those.
So I think that at a certain point it's the Napoleon Dynamite effect. You know what I mean? Like, when something is kind of so shoved in your face, even if you did find it funny at one point, you've just like been overexposed to it, or it's been overquoted to you, that it doesn't really have any meaning. I still think that those scenes are enjoyable, but like, I don't think that if you were to read this script, the script would be as funny as hearing the way that the lines are delivered by the people delivering.
Yeah, it's not, and it's not even just the delivery. Like, if Paul Rubens was born 40 years prior, he would still be, or 50 years prior, he would still be a success. Like, he has the same skill as, like, Charlie Chaplin, where it's like, the way he walks, his face, like, everything he does is very funny. You know,
where he's
like,
got the Mr. Bean quality that you look for in a
So the whole time I was watching this, part of the reason I enjoyed it was like, obviously this predate, I don't know if it predates Mr. Bean, I think it does, but Pee Wee Herman just reminds me of a mashup between Mr. Bean and Buster Bluth, and I love it so much.
So one of the
unlimited
things that
juice.
It's one of the things that I never actually noticed as a kid, because I didn't understand this, but now as an adult, like, Pee Wee's voice is Paul Rubens doing a Valley Girl impression.
No.
Like, that's always been...
I don't hear that.
The goal is that when it first started, it was like, Pee-wee is a male Valley Girl, was, like, the character.
Okay.
And you can, like, find interviews of, like, when he would just be Pee-wee on, like, David Letterman. He would tell these long jokes and stories
Dude,
The bell ringer? The bell ringer is so fucking funny.
Was he in the ground... Or the Groundlings?
He was Groundlings. He was Groundlings. That's why Elvira has a cameo in this.
Yeah, and he was going to have a cameo in Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, but he was doing Big Top Pee-wee?
Yeah, he was filming Big Top Pee-wee.
What a mistake.
But even then, her one line is even funny, where she's just like, I say you let me have him first. Like, on paper, that's not funny, but, like, the way she delivers it, it's just really funny.
The funniest delivery on that scene is the biker, and it's 100% delivery. It's just the pauses between each of them where he's like, I say we stab him. Then we hang him. Then we kill him.
The line that I wrote down that is so funny only because of the way that the guy delivers it is when he first starts the road trip and he gets in the car with Mickey. And Mickey's telling the story of why he's on the run from the cops, and it's because he cut off the don't remove this tag off of a off of a bed. And he just goes, yeah, I got a real bad temper.
I have to agree with you that the comedic timing and the speech pattern is very funny. And I think that
comes from sketch comedy. Like, that's 100%. Yeah. Like, you come from sketch comedy. Because, like, if anything, being friends with Bacon and Nate from 91 Donkey Lane, I've learned very much from them that it's like, you don't have to say something funny. You just have to say it in a funny way. And it'll, like, get the joke across.
Yeah, and I feel like Bacon has the weirdest cadences. Love him to death. But he would not be half as funny if he didn't have the weirdest cadences I've ever heard in my life. The thing about Elvira is, like, it's also fun to think about how in this movie there's the picking up a murderous hitchhiker, you know, like, kind of a murderous hitchhiker.
Yeah.
And then there's the picking up the murderous hitchhiker at the beginning of Mistress of the Dark. It's a fun little bookend. And just as an update to everybody who's probably already wondering, who's listening, no, I am not picking Elvira, Mistress of the Dark as my double feature.
Glad to clear the air on that.
Because Matt's going to take it.
No. I had so many options. I have, like, three options that I wrote down for this. So I'm going to go last already because I'm going to give people a chance to steal it. But,
I'm just
going to
pick the one I pick every time. But either
this
way.
This movie's...
Town of the Dreaded Sundown? Like, man, I'll watch Town of the Dreaded Sundown.
Goes great with Pee-wee. Once I say it, you'll know it. But I will say, speaking of him doing the Valley Girl, was the one... I don't know why I noticed things. I'm like, that I enjoyed that they did that. But I thought it was really funny that when Pee-wee dressed up like a woman... He didn't alter his voice at all. No. Like, it wasn't like he, like, did, like, a high pitch or anything. He just talked normally but had a wig and dress on.
But, yeah, you know, the guy's so, like, give me a whirl or something like that.
What I love in that scene, though, and I think at its heart, this is definitely, like, this is a sketch comedy film with just, like, a rough plot to connect the skits together. And it's done very, very well. But, like, what I like about that specific scene is there is that moment where Mickey is looking at Pee-wee after they get away from the cops, and Pee-wee's just sitting there, like, loving life in his dress. And, like, you really do get this. He says it later when he's like, look, I like you. Like, you're a good person. Like, it is the one moment of sincerity in the movie where I feel like they are actually trying to make sure the audience understands that, like, Pee-wee may be obnoxious, but he always has good intentions behind it. Like, it's the only scene where they have even a slight injection of sincerity in the movie before it just goes back into craziness. But something that I read that blew my mind about this movie. Did you know that the script for Pee-wee's Big Adventure is used in script writing classes around the world?
No, why?
Because when Phil Hartman and Paul Reubens sat down to write the movie,
Phil Hartman wrote this with
he wrote
Paul
it with
Reubens?
Him.
Oh, yeah, wow.
They had never written a movie before, so they bought a book called "How to Write a Movie" script, and they followed it to a T. So the script follows a perfect 3-act structure, screenplay wise. So, like, film classes are just like, everyone's seen this movie. and it literally follows where Act 1 ends at the 30-minute mark, Act 2 ends at the 60-minute mark, and, like, everything's resolved in 90 minutes. Like, it is a perfect three-act, 90-minute structure. So it's now, like, one of the most analyzed movies in film classes for that reason from a script-writing perspective.
That's insane. Of all the weird shit that you've dug up and explained to me on the years and years we've been podcasting together, that might be the weirdest.
So I was, one of the things that I thought when I was watching this movie is I was watching my DVD and, you know, DVDs have the scene selections and someone's job was to just come up with the scene selection names, and kudos to whoever came up with this naming. But scene 15 is called Dreams Within a Dinosaur and scene 16 is called A Dinosaur Within a Dream. I love whoever named these two scenes. That's so funny.
I hope they didn't get paid.
You know, you get the introduction of Andy. I mean, we can't skip over Large Marge, actually. Large Marge, I mean, there's not much to say about Large Marge, but what a She's fucking horrifying. Insane thing to put into a
it's
movie.
It's not scary when you watch it now, but it's literally just because this movie, it, all that dread that she is being built up, until, like, in the first half of the movie when Large Marge goes, look like this, you know, like, it was the original jump video for me. So, yeah. Like, I couldn't watch it because I knew something bad was going
to
happen.
If you want that scene to still be terrifying for you in your 30s, watch it in slow motion because that is... Brian, have you ever done that?
No.
If you watch the scene in slow motion, it's so weird because it's an actor and then they turn... And then it's the clay face before it mutates, and it is, like, just this empty shell. But I used to do that all the time. If I would see, like, a claymation scene like that, or, like, the shark blowing up in Jaws the Revenge, like, I'd be like, let me watch this in slow motion. I just want to see, like, I'd like to try to see, like, how they, like, build it out, essentially. And, man, that first, the starting point of Large Marge's face before the mutation is fucking horrifying to me.
There's something so embarrassing to me, but so honored. They're so proud of you to think that you slowed down movies to see how, like, the stop motion works. And I used to rewind movies because I thought it'd be funny to see a T-Rex spit a guy onto a toilet in Jurassic Park.
Well, I feel like that's the perfect illustration of your family dynamic.
Apparently, we're getting to a point where I wrote down so many quotes. I wrote down Deep in the Heart of Texas. Yeah. I also, I'm trying to use the phone!
Oh, man. But see, that I feel like that whole scene with the tequila dance and everything, like, yeah, that is the scene that everybody would talk about from this goddamn movie in the 80s and early 90s. And so it just feels like so stale to me that I didn't enjoy it. But, I mean, I do so love seeing Cassandra Peterson out of the Elvira makeup in this that, you know, I can live with it.
I think the perfect button on that scene is him trying to drive off on the motorcycle.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Yeah. That I didn't get how funny that was until, you know, I was an adult. Because he doesn't know how to drive a motorcycle.
He's just going with it. He's like, yeah. One of the notes that I wrote down, I actually said this to Brian yesterday when we were texting, but holy shit, Dottie is thirsty in this movie. And Pee-wee
so,
is just...
She's in the middle of a desert right there.
And he's just denying it left and right.
Well, and the funny thing is that it would the assumption in my mind would be, okay, this man-child is oblivious because I'm an oblivious man-child. And so that's the way my brain thinks. It's funnier that he knows what she's trying to do and is deflecting it like, you know that's not going to happen, Dottie. You know, like, yeah. It's so great.
The funniest part of those scenes are like in the beginning when he's like, oh, I'm a loner, Dottie, a rebel, and he like just turns around all seriously, and then him walking out is like him fighting the smile.
And then he I love that that's a get up kid song.
I was about to say, we just listened to that record last week when we were making dinner a different day, and Megan was like, how did I forget about these guys? I'm like, probably because you hate Reggie in the Full Effect so much.
But yeah, we get to Hollywood.
Is that Krull armor? That is Krull battle armor. I'm almost positive that is Krull Imperial Guard battle armor.
Do you know who it was underneath the mask? Because I just found this out the other day while doing research. The guy who like lifts up the mask and has like a very soft-spoken voice. It's Jambi. It's the guy who played Jambi on Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Oh, okay, cool.
It's such a dumb joke, right? Like, he asks a guy dressed like a battle warrior, and he's got a very soft-spoken voice, and then he asks a showgirl who's got, like, a very deep masculine voice to point him in the right direction. Those stupid jokes. But that chase through the movie studio is fucking... I love every beat of it. I love the Godzilla scene. I love that they just trash a Christmas movie. They ruin a Twisted Sister music video for arguably one of the best Twisted Sister songs. Also,
yes, that
I love. That,
there's
Burn
no
Hell.
Argument there. Burn in Hell is the best Twisted Sister song. Can I cover it?
You really do.
You should. I would, dude. You could bust out that falsetto again.
I will say about most of the bands of that era, and Scott may kill me for this, but like I feel like the biggest waste of money for a lot of like hair metal bands is a greatest hits album, you know? Because like Twisted Sister's greatest hits is Stay Hungry. That's it. Like that's their
yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing though, is like I know that they're not really hair metal. Well, later Def Leppard isn't really hair metal, right? But Pyromania is arguably a hair metal record. But you know, then they just became kind of like radio rock for
yeah, like arena,
you know,
rock or whatever.
Hysteria and stuff like that. But I knew of them growing up in a cornfield. But then when I went to college, I found the Def Leppard Greatest Hits like double CD. And so I had all their big songs, and like I didn't know half of the good stuff that they did, you know? So yeah. Like that, on the other hand, I think that works. But like Rat, you only need Out of the Cellar.
Skid Row, you need Self-Titled. I'm going to derail this and I apologize, but I watched a few years ago, like I watched a Twisted Sister documentary, but it's like, it's so fascinating to see like them before they were big and how influential they were. And just like that New York scene. And I told Matt to listen to, there's this podcast, No Dogs in Space, that like goes in deep dives of music. And I started listening to Beastie Boys and it was about that. And the reason, just so you know, Matt, the reason that the episodes are like 2 hours is because it's like, I'm 40 minutes in and we haven't even talked about the Beastie Boys. It's like setting up what was happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Skid Row and Twisted Sister, I will never sit down and be like, they were absolutely the most talented bands of that hair rock scene or whatever. But of a lot of that hair rock scene, like, I would actually want to talk to Sebastian Bach or Dee Snider. Like, I'm like, yeah. I'm like, they actually seem like they're like dudes who get it. They don't have like a big ego about who they were. Like
Sebastian Bach, are you sure?
I don't know, man. Sebastian Bach was a lead actor on 3 seasons of Gilmore Girls, playing aged dad playing in a punk band with a bunch of teenagers. I feel like he's got a little bit of like self-awareness in him.
Okay, all right,
but like,
I accept this.
But like Bret Michaels, like no. I have no desire to, like, you know what I mean? Like I can
or
enjoy Poison
from
afar.
Motley
Crue. Yeah.
Oh, Poison, that's a great suggestion for if people are like, oh, I need a hair metal greatest hits, like, yeah, just go with that, you know, go with their greatest hits. Because
Poison actually did have like 2 or 3 good songs on every album, so just get
but
them
no
compiled
yeah,
into the single
yeah, no
like,
really
exactly.
good album. And then there's like you know, Dokken, where I think the Dokken had like 3 really good records.
To tie it back to the show, just so they were going through all these bands in the New York scene, like these punk bands that were super influential that never really got famous, and this one band they were talking about, they kind of put on like a war style show. And it's because their front man was screaming Mad George. And
oh,
it was like,
shit.
Yeah, he was like a huge influence into like that whole New York punk scene. He was the front man for like some shitty punk band that used to just like do crazy special effects on stage.
That's amazing.
That's amazing.
I will
I love
listen
that.
To the fuck out of that, because that is basically anything screaming Mad George has touched, I want in my life. It's in yeah. some way, shape, or form.
So we get through the studio chase scene. Pee-wee gets his bike back, but he stops to save a bunch of animals from a burning pet shop. And yeah. I could just watch Paul Rubens running, screaming, holding snakes in his hand on a yeah. loop for like 10 hours, and it would still make me laugh.
But no, it's the buildup. It's the every time he goes in, he just stares at the snakes in disgust, where like you really think he's going to leave them to die.
But then we get watching... This scene is absolutely brilliant. But first off, we need to talk about a Brian story. Pee-wee gets caught. He's brought into the studio. They're showing him the footage, and he's sinking deeper and deeper into the couch. And all I can think of is a story that I don't know if Brian has told on this podcast, but the infamous Brian causing a disturbance on the school bus tape.
Oh my God.
Do you mind telling people this story real quick?
Dude, it was insane. I went on a bus with a few of my friends, and I like live like a mile away. Like, I didn't have to ride the bus. I just wanted to for my friends. It was like, I did it for a few months. And like, I climbed on the bus and I saw my friend out the window. So I flipped him off and I called him like a fucking prick. And then like, our other friend came on the bus and we were like just fucking around. But one of the kids in the back that we weren't talking, we were just really just fucking with our friends, like got really scared because we were like really mean to each other, but it was all of our friends. I got suspended for 1 week for gang activity, and I had to watch this video and have these people explain to my parents that me and five other white children were in a gang.
But I think the best part of that story is that you told me that like, you're sitting there watching this video, and in the video, one of you says to the other, like, hey, man, I think there might be a camera
Nick
on this
Hickey. Bus. I said it to Nick Hickey, because Nick Hickey kept cursing. I was like, dude, I was like, shut up. They're filming us. And he looks right at the camera. He's like, there's no fucking sound on these fucking things. We're in, like, sixth grade. Are you fucking this cheap-ass school? They're not going to put a fucking camera with sound on it.
And I just imagine Brian, like, the way that Pee-wee's just sitting in the chair, like, sinking down. I'm, like, imagining Brian sitting between my mom and dad as they're playing this video for them. But we get to the drive-in sequence. Arguably one of the best closing scenes I've ever seen in a comedy. It does such a great job of bringing back all of these characters. It's a great motif. And when you see Pee-wee in the movie and he is playing the role of someone who has no confidence in their acting, it is so fucking funny. Like, when he's just staying there and you can see that he is like mouthing what they're saying to like stay on time.
And he kept looking directly at the camera and then looking away.
And then the dubbed voice, paging Mr. Herman, Mr. Herman, please come to the front desk.
Such a dumb joke, but I love
it. It's so good. And then Francis gets shot towards the moon, and the movie ends. Beautiful. So, episode 300, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Brian, what's the movie you're going to double feature this with?
Ed Wood. Anytime okay. You can get tied into Tim Burton in some way. I'm a double feature with Ed Wood.
Yep, totally makes sense. All right, Scott?
I'm going to go with Bad Channels because the clown nightmare just feels like a Psychotic Symphony
yes.
music video.
For sure.
Or ICP.
So I'm gonna pick a different movie than this, but when I was doing the research, we talk about how IMDb trivia has some of like the dumbest pieces of trivia ever. One of them just called out that at the end of Buckaroo Banzai, the characters walk towards the camera and one is dressed like Pee-wee Herman and Jeff Goldblum is dressed like Pee-wee Herman during the rodeo. And I'm like, I don't think that was intentional. But what I am going to pick this with, shocker to no one, is another movie that really captures the high energy of a guy going to Hollywood and then getting a movie made about him. The Muppets movie, in which Kermit the Frog goes to Hollywood and gets a bunch of friends to make a movie.
Also, Brian's reaction. Okay, people that are listening to this on your podcasting app, Brian looked like if Paul Rubens is doing a Valley Girl in his Pee-wee impressions, Brian just did a Valley Girl because his eyes rolled so fucking hard. I thought he was going to go blind.
And it is worth giving a quick shout out. You know, love him or hate him, Kevin Smith has been very open that Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back was just him trying to do a remake of Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And makes sense when you think about it. It follows the exact same storyline, mm-hmm. almost to a T. But, all right, what is something that you guys have watched that you want to talk about?
So I'm trying to start writing again. And for me, I watch a lot of movies and I just get like, I can never make this movie.
Yeah.
So I'm like, let me go and watch these people I look up to is like original films, like short films, independent films. Ari Aster, he has a short on YouTube. It's called There's Something Strange About the Johnsons. It's not a horror movie. It's the most disturbing 20 minutes I've ever watched. not a snuff film, not a horror movie. It is so uncomfortable. My jaw dropped the whole time. Like, I don't even want to suggest people watch it, but I also do. I think you should watch it, but understand that I'm telling you you're going to feel uncomfortable. And I'll tell you guys about it afterwards if you have no intention of watching it, but I'm not going to do it on air. And then secondly, I watched Mortal Kombat last night. And
yes, like, so did I, yeah, dude.
What's everyone's problem? Like,
I don't know what the fuck they were expecting. Do they remember the first two Mortal Kombat movies?
The only thing I will say that I hated about it, that I think that they, but it wasn't any, I enjoyed the movie as a whole. I hated what they did with Reptile. Other than that, it was just loads of fucking fun.
I enjoyed it because I turned my brain off for an hour and 40 minutes. It is, and I actually really liked some of the characterizations. I thought Kano was really fun, really like funny too. I mean, give somebody an Australian accent and they say fuck a bunch of times and I'm sold, you know? But I mean, I thought Sonya Blade was actually a much better casting design or decision than, you know, I liked her a lot better. She seemed like more of a badass, more like she earned the fact that she's, you know, just like a highly skilled fighter. You know, I really loved that. I didn't love what they did with Reptile, but I liked it. You know, I actually have no criticism for the movie because I was expecting something fucking
No one's
awful.
Going into that expecting fucking, you know, Citizen Kane when you're watching exactly. Mortal Kombat. Like
Citizen Kano? Oh, that's a crossover.
Brian, there you go. But, there's your short film.
Yeah, like, but the other one that I wanted to mention is also on HBO Max and Godzilla vs. Kong. Kong, I enjoyed. It's just exactly what you think it is. You know, it's another popcorn movie where I get to turn my brain off. And my only critique is that I preferred Godzilla King of Monsters because there were a ton of kaiju in it, you know? Like, just Kong, Godzilla, and Mecha Godzilla. But, I mean, it's still fun.
Let me ask you guys, because I'm running out of time, so it's not like I can watch them first. I do want to watch King Kong, Godzilla vs. Kong. Is King of Monsters in Skull Island? Like, are both of them worth a watch, or is just one of them
so
worth a watch?
Watch King of Monsters. This is my take. I liked King of Monsters. I've watched enough segments of Skull Island that I don't love it because I just don't love Kong that much. I think he's fine.
Yeah.
And the whole point of that movie, I think, is, well, the reason why I like King of Monsters the most of the three, right? Mm-hmm. Of Skull Island, well, of the four. Like, there's Godzilla 2015 or whatever it was. The one that had Bryan Cranston in it. And Elizabeth Olsen. That one I like the least because it's got the most amount of humans on screen.
Gotcha.
You know? But then up from that, I would say Skull Island because a lot of humans are on screen and the big bad in it is a little disappointing for me. I mean, it's still a kaiju, but it's just like didn't really do it for me. Like, I've watched I've watched the ultimate
King of Monsters.
Godzilla versus Kong. And then King of Monsters. King of Monsters is literally 70-80% kaiju battle.
There's people talking, but it's
very, very, very light.
Well, and that's, I mean, but also to answer your question as well, Brian, the reality is, like, I mean, you like Godzilla movies about as much as I do, which is, like, I'll watch them if they're on. I don't, like, make it a point to watch them. But, like, Godzilla movies, in my opinion, like, if they're trying to build a cinematic universe out of Godzilla, like, that is a fool's errand because those movies are supposed to be that you can just jump into like the 15th Godzilla movie with absolutely no context. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like just
I would even
it on.
Say Godzilla versus Kong. Like, I didn't need to watch the first of the Toho reboot Godzillas. It's not a great movie. I just watched it because it was on streaming services. But King of Monsters is the perfect one because you don't need to watch anything before it to understand everything about what, because they do little info dumps. They even did info dumps in Godzilla versus Kong, so you could go in seeing it without having watched any of the other ones and still enjoy the movie and enjoy the characters, be like the human characters. But what I'll say, last thing I'll say about it is that the people that, you know, like how people have this problem with the Godzilla redesign because they're like, he's got a fat ass and I don't like his face, blah blah blah. I think he looks awesome, and I think that CGI is really tight.
Nice. I'll have to check it out then.
So I'm going to talk about two quick things. I watched the documentary on Netflix, Why Did You Kill Me, which started off okay and then, like, slowly just kind of, like, it's got less interesting as it went on. But it's about a girl who was killed in, like, a pseudo drive-by shooting, and her mom and family had a long history with the cops being arrested all the time, so they didn't trust the cops to handle the case. So this was during the MySpace days. They made a fake MySpace account of the daughter and used it to track down all of the gang members that were involved in the drive-by shooting and make them fall in love with this girl that they had killed, and then be like, if you love me so much, why the fuck did you kill me? And, like, torture these guys with guilt, essentially. I feel like by the time the movie was over, I was just like, you guys really only had like a 30-minute, like, this is like a great episode of a true crime show that you were like, we got to make it 90 minutes. And, like, it just felt like they were really trying to stretch it out. And then I texted you guys both yesterday that, based on a reference from Kathleen from my favorite episode of, I checked out a show called Cruel Summer, and it's a Freeform show, which I normally don't get into, but the way that this show is formatted is really, really cool. It's going to be an 8-episode run, and it takes place in 1993, 1994, 1995, right? And it jumps around in those three timelines. But, like, so for the first episode, it'll say all of the events took place on approximately January 23rd of 1993, 1994, 1995. So you're jumping around in this timeline and seeing how dramatically different this one character is over those 3 years. And while you're following it, you find that, like, she was a really dorky kid, and then she started dating this really cool guy, and then a year later, she's, like, going to court and everybody hates her. And you find out that, like, this popular girl went missing, and this girl who was dorky saw what happened and didn't report it to the cops because she saw a chance to be popular. And then the second episode is all from the perspective of the girl who got kidnapped. So I think it's like every episode is you're getting pieces of the story from the perspectives of like 8 different people while the events were happening. And I'm hoping that the last episode is from the perspective of the kidnapper, because they tell you who it is up front. I won't tell you guys who it is, but they tell you who it is. And it's like, yo, I want to know the story of like what was fucking going on to lead to this. So like, I'm actually kind of hooked. Like, I'm like, all right, when's the next episode? Like, it's every Tuesday, a new episode. So I'm like, oh, I need to know what's going to happen with this shit. It's fucking wild. But also the sound, like the one episode, the whole episode is soundtracked to songs from the Cranberries. And like another, like, it's just like,
it's very brick to me.
Yeah, it's cool. There's like a trip hop cover of Zombie in the second episode, and I need to find out who did it because it's so fucking good. Like, it's like literally if Portishead covered Zombie. It sounds,
I feel like,
so
that's
good.
Like, that's your dream music right there. Trip hop covers of 90s rock music, radio rock.
But they throw, when there's just a perfect soundtrack, I don't want to overstay my welcome because I already talked about two things. I will say everyone should watch Q Into the Storm, and at one point they do like this choir cover of Go Ask Alice, and I don't even know if that's the name of the song, but
who knows. But
dude, so perfect. And yeah, everyone needs to watch it. It's one of the best documentaries out right now. They actually don't really focus on the conspiracy theory itself. The whole thing is like, let's find out who's doing this. Like, that's really it. It's like, who is behind this? And it's just like, it's kind of funny where it's just like, you kind of look at like people, you're like, you follow these virgins. Like, this is who you follow.
Oh, God. All right. Well, 300 episodes in. Let's do 300 more, guys. but thank you so much for watching and listening. Obviously, we'll say a lot more to everybody when the best of year 6 drops, because
yes,
it's running really
long.
But love you guys. Thank you for sticking around. You're the best.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.